Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Hi, this is Here and Now Anytime, where we give you a little news, a little something you weren't expecting, and always a fresh, in-depth perspective on current events, arts and culture, and stories that matter. Subscribe or follow to get all our episodes out every weekday. And if you like what you hear, tell a friend about us to help spread the word. Now here's the show.
We need to be looking at addiction as a public health crisis that it is. We have almost 5 people a day in Oregon that are dying from overdoses.
Oregon is bringing back criminal penalties for possession, but don't call it a return to the war on drugs. It's Friday, March 8th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. A few years ago, Oregon lifted criminal penalties for possession of small amounts of drugs, including meth and cocaine. But now, lawmakers are backtracking, in part. Today on the show, we'll hear from the state's Senate Majority Leader about why, and hear from an addiction recovery group that says reform takes time. Also, that's one of the many sounds once heard around the clock in Imperial Beijing, the drum tower.
Early foreign visitors to the city in the 18th century write in their letters home that they couldn't sleep at night because it was so noisy.
The sounds of old Beijing echo into eternity, even though that city has transformed into something completely new. That story coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, there was that big speech last night by a guy named Joe. Whether you watched it or not, you've probably heard plenty about the State of the Union by now. But we wanted to dig in a little more into one thing the president said. Biden said the U.S. military will lead an emergency mission to build a pier in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Gaza.
No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman spoke to Peter O'Dowd and told us it's going to be a while before this pier is actually operational.
Well, it's going to take several weeks, we're told, so this is not really a quick fix to the humanitarian crisis playing out in Gaza right now. But there is a lot of support for this. Several European countries say they're going to be involved. So is the United Arab Emirates. The ships will be coming in from Cyprus. And the United Nations, I gather, will be involved. And while some aid experts call it kind of a diversion, a former U.S. aid chief for Gaza, Dave Hardin, told NPR's Daniel Estrin that this could actually be a precedent for Gaza, creating what he called facts on the ground, kind of a trade route into Gaza without facing some of the obstacles coming from Israel in those overland routes.
And speaking of Israel, have we heard from them on this announcement? Do they need to give their blessing?
Well, they've been talking about this idea for some time, actually, and working with Cyprus. So they would be involved in screening ships coming from Cyprus.
All right. Well, we heard the president say that there would be no boots on the ground here, but an army brigade would be constructing the pier. What dangers do these service members face? I mean, would they be vulnerable to, say, missile attacks from the Houthis or other groups?
Well, I think the real danger is kind of what they have on the ground in Gaza. But we're told that they're not going to be coming on shore. There's still a lot to be worked out on how physically they're going to do this. So I think there's a lot of planning ahead going on at the Pentagon right now that they've been ordered by the president to do this.
All right. Meanwhile, we know the humanitarian situation is still terrible in Gaza. That's why the president was bringing this up. Aside from the new plan, the United States has been airdropping supplies of food. How effective have those been?
Well, I mean, there are reports today that a couple of Palestinians were actually killed by airdrops because the parachute didn't open and the supplies came crashing down. That's, you know, one of those big dangers of doing airdrops. And one of the key reasons why aid workers always say that land routes are just much better. The U.S. says it wasn't American airdrops, by the way, that killed those Palestinians. There are other countries doing these. But again, Most aid groups say this is just not the answer, and they're angry with the Biden administration. They want the Biden administration to do much more to push Israel harder to open up more land aid routes, which are, you know, really key in this.
Well, right. So if those are the fastest or best way to get aid into Gaza, what are the prospects for land routes?
Well, I mean, the Israelis have given many excuses for blocking things. They need to check every truck going in. There have been Israeli protesters blocking some of the routes, some government ministers who oppose aid getting into Gaza altogether. And there have been problems, you know, delivering supplies once they're inside Gaza because the roads are dangerous, because people are so desperate. They've been swarming trucks. There's been looting. So there's really a lot of problems, not just the bureaucratic obstacles from the Israelis. The UN is testing out a new route this week, a road that they say the Israeli military has been using for its own logistics. So there is work being done on that, but it does take time.
There is no deal yet for a ceasefire. We know that Hamas negotiators have left the talks in Cairo. Is there any hope at this point for a ceasefire before the holy month of Ramadan, which is now just a few days away? What's the status of these talks?
I mean, there was a lot of hope that there would be a six-week ceasefire deal and exchange of hostages, but those hopes are faded now for that to begin in Ramadan. The U.S. says that it's the ball's in Hamas's court, that the Israelis have put a deal on the table and Hamas is making new demands. They want a longer ceasefire. They want more guarantees that the Israelis are going to leave Gaza. These are all things that the U.S. had thought had kind of that they had worked out. So it doesn't look like it's going to happen by Ramadan. But the U.S. is continuing these talks and pushing hard to get some kind of ceasefire in place soon.
NPR's Michelle Kellerman is reporting from the State Department. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Remember, there's always a lot more to read about the conflict at npr.org. We're going to take a short break now, but when we return, Peter gets two perspectives on the recriminalization of drugs in Oregon. The long road to recovery after the break.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Lisa in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
An experiment to decriminalize serious drugs like heroin and methamphetamine has been abandoned in Oregon. Lawmakers recently passed a bill to roll back ballot measure 110, which eliminated criminal penalties for drug possession and tried to steer people toward treatment. But a wave of overdose deaths and open drug use on the streets of Portland proved too much for state lawmakers to ignore. The new bill reimposes criminal penalties for drugs and passed through the liberal state legislature with bipartisan support. Kate Lieber, Oregon Senate Majority Leader, joins us now. She's a Democrat from Portland and co-author of the bill. Senator, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So when this ballot measure passed in 2020, it was seen in some circles as this grand experiment that would be a model for other progressive states. What happened to that dream? Why did it fail?
Well, I think that if you recall what happened when ballot measure 110 was voted in, we were in the middle of a global pandemic. Fentanyl had not quite hit Oregon the way it is now. And I think, you know, fundamentally that coming out of that pandemic and with fentanyl now replacing black tar heroin as the main drug, I think what happened was that people started looking for different solutions to the drug crisis.
Yeah. As the fentanyl crisis blew up across the country, I mean, Portland became somewhat infamous as this place where people were using drugs openly in public. They were overdosing. Do you think this could have worked if it weren't for the surge in fentanyl and overdose deaths?
You know, I don't know. I fundamentally believe that we need to be looking at addiction as a public health crisis that it is. And I think people were dying and are dying. We have almost 5 people a day in Oregon that are dying from overdoses. We did not want to go back to the war on drugs. The war on drugs didn't prevent this problem from happening in the first place. And because fentanyl is so cheap and so available and so deadly, we had a couple of problems. One, kids weren't taking drugs seriously. There were actually steeper penalties for underage drinking than using some of these hard drugs. That was sending a very confusing message. And fundamentally, our first responders, including our police, were asking for better tools.
Let's talk about some of those rules that the police had. Under Measure 110, cops could issue a ticket and a $100 fine for someone caught using the drugs. There would be no jail time, and then even the fine would be waived if people sought medical treatment or recovery. Ultimately, very few people got that treatment. How would your bill change the law and give new tools to Oregon?
Well, it urgently expands drug treatment. We are not going to get out of this crisis that we're in until we have additional treatment available for people who need it. And so the goal is to make that treatment more available and save lives. We also prioritized prevention and education because we've got to stop kids from experimenting with fentanyl and sort of these other deadly drugs. But then we also knew we had to intervene on drug use. Our first responders and our police needed tools to stop public drug use. So we were having a problem with people using drugs in public and interfering with people's safe use of the streets. And the other thing that we did is we wanted to make sure that we stopped drug dealers and we enhanced sentences for those dealers who were targeting people living in shelters, those in recovery, and people who were using our parks.
Isn't one of the tools also that people can now go to jail for possessing drugs? How important is that to have a stick to hold people accountable?
Well, I think anytime that we're talking about sort of putting accountability back in a system, there's a push and a pull. We heard from a lot of people during this process. We heard from hundreds of people who testified, and we heard a couple of things. One, we heard the police need to be able to confiscate drugs. And in order to confiscate drugs, you have to have a crime. You know, you have a Fourth Amendment right. And so we knew we needed to give back that tool for them. We also heard from people who said, look, I didn't hit rock bottom until I was facing jail time, and I needed that in order to really spur me into treatment. So we give a lot of off-ramps for people in this bill before you get to a jail sentence.
As you know, critics of the bill are concerned about backtracking. They say it's going to be a quick return to overwhelming the justice system, that people who end up in jail will be primarily people of color. I mean, what do you say to that? Can you promise that won't happen with this new law?
You know, we were very concerned with that and have built in a lot of data tracking in this bill to make sure we're tracking those things. But I will tell you, it is not humane to allow people to remain on the streets in the throes of their addiction and say it's okay to figure out when they want to get treatment. The second thing is people should be able to use their streets without encountering people who are using fentanyl and meth in front of them and try to figure out how to explain that to their children as they're walking down these streets.
Finally, just before we let you go, I know the debate over this bill to recriminalize drugs was emotional for a lot of lawmakers because you've described the numbers in the state of Oregon. They are very high. The overdose crisis has affected so many people there and everywhere, frankly. May I ask, has it touched your life? And I wonder if that's shaped your thinking at all.
Yeah, it certainly has touched my life. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in Oregon that wasn't touched by this. Fundamentally, we're not going to get out of this crisis without expanding treatment and understanding that people with an addiction have a public health need that they need to get addressed. And that's what we're really trying to do. We spent a lot of time in this bill talking about sort of this recriminalization aspect of it. And it does so many other things than simply whether we've recriminalized drugs or not. And I don't want that to be lost.
Kate Lieber is Oregon Senate Majority Leader. She co-wrote a bill to reintroduce penalties for drug possession and, as she described, get people help. Senator Lieber, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's get another point of view on this difficult topic. Tara Hurst is the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. It's a group that supported Measure 110 implementation. And Tara, Senator Lieber said that 5 people a day are dying of drug overdoses in Oregon. Some people have seen those numbers and have said that clearly Measure 110 did not work. Do you make the same connection?
No, and it's more importantly, it's not if I make the connection, but it's actually that, you know, we've had national and local researchers that were funded to study the impacts of Measure 110. And one of the pieces of work that they really studied was the overdose deaths, because it is an alarming increase. From 2019 to 2020, there was a 70% increase in drug overdose deaths in Oregon. The data really shows that Measure 110 had no impact, not only on overdose death rates, but also crime and houselessness. So that is the data and the evidence that I had hoped they would have used to write this policy.
All right. Well, let's take a look at the new law and some of the provisions that are designed to help people get into treatment before they're sent to jail. The bill puts $211 million into recovery and treatment programs. It offers people a chance to expunge their records. What do you think? Will it work?
Well, I think it's important. This is one of those, the devil's in the details. So it sounds great. However, our public defense system is in shambles. So in order for folks to use these new off-ramps and on-ramps, they would need to have public defenders connecting them to those services. So that kind of puts a roadblock at that treatment, assuming that we have treatment available. Expungement happens after 3 years. 3 years is a really long time when you are somebody trying to get into recovery and get housing and a job and kind of get your life back on track. And this is hoping that the state will do a better job implementing House Bill 4002 than they did for Measure 110. And, you know, after spending 3 years on the front lines in this, I unfortunately have a lot of doubts that this is something that can actually happen.
I want to go back to the fentanyl crisis, because the overdose statistics, they're very troubling in Oregon. Help us put a face to those numbers and help us understand what's happening to people in your state.
Any overdose is a preventable death. We know that people's sons and daughters and parents are dying at an alarming rate, but we're going to still see these types of overdose deaths when we're not actually addressing this as a true crisis. So right now you have folks, because of Measure 110, doing outreach, handing out Narcan, working with folks, trying to connect them to these desperately needed services. We also have people waiting in line at 6 a.m. every day to get into detox. When you're turning hundreds of people away, our attention should not be on whether or not we should put them in a jail cell to wait for that health care. Our attention should be on how do we stand up more detox beds, more intensive outpatient and housing, and how do we reduce the barriers to folks who are ready to get off the streets and ready to get off of fentanyl. Fentanyl is definitely devastating our community, but we also have not had a government that has been willing to be responsive as it's needed to be in this crisis.
But the government of Oregon, if you compare it to states across the country, I bet is probably one of the most progressive in the country. And there are probably those listening to this thinking like, well, why is Oregon one of the worst in the country in terms of drug abuse and overdose? I mean, what else explains the problem? Because Oregon is investing money and effort into taking people away from the criminal justice system.
But that's really recent, right? These things take time. And when you're starting from kind of the bottom, it takes a long time to work your way out of it. And I don't know how to really grapple with the idea that we are progressive in a lot of our policies, but we're not great at implementation. And so we do a lot of quick fixes. And ultimately, what you need is long-term strategy and long-term investments.
Tara Hurst is the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance in Oregon. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Lisa Mullins recently spoke with someone who's trying to save something that you can't see. or easily preserve in a museum. When we return, David Rennie shares some evocative memories and sounds from old Beijing, a city that has destroyed many of its historic buildings in its transformation from an ancient capital into a high-tech megalopolis. That's after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor VCU Massey Comprehensive Cancer Center, who, as an NCI-designated comprehensive cancer center in the country's top 4%, is unconditionally committed to keeping loved ones in their lives. MasseyCancerCenter.org/comprehensive.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There is some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The capital of China, Beijing, is a modern and global city with cars, subway trains, and lots of people. It sounds like pretty much any other modern developed city, but that wasn't always the case. That's the sound of Beijing's Imperial Drum Tower. It once sounded the time of day in the city, and it symbolized a lot more. The Economist has a podcast called Drum Tower, and one recent episode explored the sounds of old Beijing, including that drum tower. Joining us to talk about that is The Economist Beijing Bureau Chief David Rennie. Hi, David.
Hello.
So your weekly podcast is named for the Drum Tower. It covers a lot of aspects of life in China, but you say the Drum Tower in particular holds a special place in your heart. How come?
That's right, because it's a very good window on the fact that sound was unusually important in Imperial Beijing. Beijing, under the emperors, was a very secretive city of people who lived in courtyards, behind closed doors, behind high walls. You could just kind of glimpse the roofs of mansions and temples over these low grey walls, and the emperor couldn't be seen by any commoner. They were not allowed to even look at him. But the sound of the people of Beijing, from the emperor at the top to the street sellers at the bottom, was an incredibly important way that people sort of just sensed humanity around them and set the order of their day. And so we decided to explore that in an episode of the podcast.
And the drums themselves, what did they signal? What were they for?
They were very important. So the drum tower, the Gulou, lies right on the central sacred meridian that runs through the city, due north of the Imperial Forbidden City. And the drums would signal, for example, the beginning of the nighttime curfew when the city gates were closed. And if you were on the wrong side of the city gates, you were stuck outside Beijing for the night. They signaled when it opened. And then all night, they would beat the drums to set the time, to guide police patrols around the city. In fact, early foreign visitors in the 18th century in their diaries wrote about they couldn't sleep at night because the whole city was so noisy. And people lived in courtyard houses where all of the life of the family home took place in these courtyards surrounded by blank exterior walls, so you couldn't see your neighbors. You couldn't see anyone as you walked up these blank alleyways. But behind those blank gray walls, you had lots of humanity going on. And so if you were selling things at the lowest level of the sound hierarchy of Beijing, say you were selling fruit from the countryside, or you were coming to cut people's hair or to offer medicine or anything, each of those sellers had distinctive cries that allowed people in the houses behind their closed walls to know that they could come out and ask someone to come in and sell them some fruit or some milk or some or a service like a haircut.
For instance, there's a watermelon man, and we know of this from the United States as well, parts in the South. We're going to listen now to some excerpts from your podcast, and let's start with one that features the sound of the watermelon vendor on his route, coming through, basically saying, I'm here, come and get it.
来块凉来，你愿瞧着西瓜金桥。
If you grew up in a courtyard house on one of Beijing's ancient alleyways, then this is the sound of summer. I've talked to older Beijingers whose first memory of a cold, sweet summer treat isn't ice cream, because that was a luxury a half century ago. They remember slices of watermelon, cut up and sold on the corner of the street, even in the days when food was rationed. And this is the cry of the watermelon seller.
So you were able to resurrect these sounds from a man named Colin Su Yan Chinnery, who is a Chinese-Brit sound artist, and he's co-founder of what sounds like a fantastic museum in Beijing, the Sound Art Museum. Where did he get the sounds?
So he has been living in Beijing since the 1980s, and he is a sound artist who has been trying to capture some of these precious street-level but also imperial sounds before they disappear. And he's now founded this museum, as you say, the Sound Art Museum, in a suburb of Beijing. And it's just a wonderful place. You stand there surrounded by these different cries. And older Beijingers who've taken their grandkids there, you can see them sometimes with the tears running down their face, because this is taking them straight back to the sounds of childhood that they hadn't heard in decades.
So along with the watermelon man, there are other tradesmen you mentioned. Tell us about them.
Modern Beijing has lost a lot of these sounds, but actually a couple of them still survive. So there's this really distinctive noise that even in my modern apartment building I sometimes hear, which is the knife sharpener, and he has these iron plates that he clanks together, and that tells you to go downstairs with your kitchen knives, and he will sharpen them for you on a whetstone attached to the back of his bicycle. And they still do exist, although they're getting old now, and they're kind of dying out.
And take us to one of the oldest parts of old Beijing. And these are the men who you often see gathered around in various countries who spend time together and chat and eat and do whatever else. And these particular men had a penchant for crickets. What's that all about?
So if listeners remember the film The Last Emperor, at the very beginning, the little boy emperor is given a cricket in a cage by a soldier in the Forbidden City. And this was something that ordinary Beijingers, but also aristocrats, would keep a cricket, but the richer you were, the fancier the cage. And this was one of the pastimes. So if you imagine kind of three layers of sound, you have the street hawkers, the traders at the bottom of the pile, and then in the middle you had, you know, aristocrats or army officers who served the emperor living in courtyard houses quite close to the palace. And they would raise songbirds and train them to sing beautiful songs. It might take years. And they would judge each other by how expensive the cages were. And then a sound that you still hear as a pastime, but it's become incredibly rare, is this very mysterious, almost like a sort of 1950s science fiction sound of a UFO. That's another of the sounds that Colin Su Yan Chinnery has captured in his museum.
That eerie thrumming, that noise of flying saucers from an old science fiction film. That's birds too. Those are pigeon whistles. Pigeon whistles are tiny flutes. They're made from bamboo or gourds, and they are sewn into the tail feathers of homing pigeons that old Beijingers loved to keep in rooftop coops. They would release the birds twice a day to circle in a flock in the sky. And even 20 years ago, you could hear quite often this melancholy noise like a theremin. I remember hearing them when I very first came to Beijing in the mid-90s and being confused because you'd hear this bizarre noise, and after a while I realized it only happened when there were pigeons overhead. But back in imperial times, pigeon whistles were another way for courtiers to signal wealth and cultivation.
I want to get back to the highest end of the pyramid and those who have all the power, those who want to display it and show it. And this brings us back to the drum tower. By the way, tell us briefly what that looks like today.
So Beijing's Drum Tower is this magnificent three-story tower with thick red walls and this beautiful dark grey roof with upturned eaves. There are actually drum towers still in cities all over China, but Beijing's is one of the finest surviving ones. And it had a kind of an official government purpose. Those drums that you hear beating out that fixed rhythm there, they not only told the time, they would signal the opening and the closing of the city's gates. They told officials when to come to work. And the fact that the drums were accurate in terms of telling the time was more than just a public service. You know, the drum tower's been compared to Big Ben in London, but it was more than that. It was a sacred promise that the right emperor was on the throne, that he was in direct contact with the heavens. And one of the ways you knew that he had the mandate of heaven was that the right things happened at the appropriate time. And so there was no accident that the finest clocks in China were in the imperial city, tended by the kingdom's best astronomers, because their job was to make sure that the regular passage of time and its marking by things like the drum tower was the ultimate symbol that this was an orderly universe and an orderly empire run by the right ruler.
David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist newspaper. His podcast is called The Drum Tower. So nice to talk to you, David. Thank you.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
That's our show. It comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Julia Corcoran and Mark Navin. Today's editors were Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, Kat Welch, and Ahmad Daman, who is on our staff for a little while and helping guide our coverage of the war in the Middle East in particular. He edited yesterday's story about Houthi rebels, which I forgot to mention then. Sorry, Daman. And which was really informative, so go back and listen to yesterday's episode if you missed it. We're glad to have you on board, Daman. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto also wrote our theme music, along with Max Liebman and me, Chris Bentley. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin, and the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great weekend. Don't forget to spring forward on Sunday, and we'll be back with you on Monday.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Turn shipping to your advantage with USPS Ground Advantage service. Learn how to gain a competitive edge at USPS.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.